You have your Bibles, please turn to the book of Job. The book of Job. I met a lady recently, a few years ago, who one day lost her father to the ravages of time. And shortly after that, her husband was flying commercial flight, and middle of the flight had a heart attack and couldn't land in time, and he passed away on the plane before the plane could land. And not long after that, one of her two sons contracted HIV virus from discretions and choices he had made. He was now married with three small children. While she's packing up to go to visit that son, her other son walked out to get the mail, and car ran off the road and took his life. As she goes to see her other son, who survived, the one who has HIV, and he died shortly thereafter. In a short span of time, lost her father, husband, and two children. It just underscores the fact that life can be very cruel. Life can be very painful. And our tribulations do not have to be Job-esque for us to ask some serious questions about what's going on. And if you're like me, you saw the news coverage of a few days ago in Oklahoma City, a terrible, ferocious tornado, 200 miles an hour going through a town. And you heard the accounts of not just destruction of houses, but also a school where children were inside, and at least a dozen or more children were killed. And you have to tear up at stories like that and go hold your kids and think, wow, those families did not wake up that day thinking my kid's going to die today in a tornado. And their life is forever changed. And those things happen. And those things happen and don't really, it's not just about ourselves and just about the pain or suffering, but we have to ask ourselves some very serious questions about the deep nature relationship we're going to have with God. Because at these times, Satan is poised to take advantage of us during opportunities like this and times like this. He says this is an opportunity to create doubt and fear and skepticism in believers and non-believers alike, and he's ready to jump all over that. And we might think that we're just strong people, we can handle things, and we theoretically talk about it at times like this, but when it comes to actually us experiencing pain, we might just draw back a bit. And Satan has a way of just piling one brick on and another brick on and another brick on. And we're asking, okay, God, are you there? Can you throw me a lifesaver, please? I'm ready to be bailed out of this. And we just might ask the unthinkable, okay, what do we think about God anymore? How can he allow this to happen? Does he care about us? And is he fair? What's going on in the world? Does he know what the pain I'm going through? And is he going to do something about it? That's in essence what Job was asking through his whole ordeal. And the book of Job is not just a message about how to handle misfortune or how to endure times of pain or how to get through better times. The message of Job is certainly about Job, but it's more about God himself. And James 5 and verse 11, our scripture reading, summarizes it very well. Have you heard the endurance of Job? Have you heard about the patience of Job? I want to suggest to you that the book of Job is more about God than it is about Job himself. Have you noticed that Job does not reflect so much about the loss that he sustained, but he's more concerned about his relationship with God? God, where are you? Why are you indifferent to me? Why don't you make it better? What are these friends that are helping to comfort me and support me, they're not really doing a good job of that. So God, where are you? And those friends and the three friends in Elihu, the fourth friend in chapter 32 through 37, all recognize God's power. They have no problem saying God is powerful, God is great, God is loving, he can do anything else. But they had a trouble reconciling the fact that there's harsh realities in life. So what do we come up with? The problem is they had bad conclusions. And their conclusion was that God always blesses those who are good. He's going to punish those who are evil. And that's a very common way of thinking. If you're doing good, God has blessed you, how they define good. And if things are going wrong, then God is trying to send you a message. Turn to Job chapter 4. We're going to take a perusal through Job until we get to the last part and just try to drive it home. But I don't have time to go through all the details like I'd like, but I'll do the best I can here. And one of the friends, Eliphaz, speaking. He says, Job chapter 4, look at verse 7. He says, remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed? And according to what I've seen, I want you to stop right there, verse 8. Not according to what God has said or what God has revealed, but it's according to what I've seen. Here's my experience, and there's problem number one, the authority of where you're going to about how you figure things out. So according to what I've seen, Eliphaz, those who plow iniquity, those who sow trouble harvest it. And by the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they come to an end. In other words, Eliphaz has this all figured out. He's got the rule, this is the law, and this is the way things always happen. You ever been around somebody who makes an observation about life and gives a maxim about life like this, and you think, what in the world are you saying? Where did you get that from? What world do you live on? Because what you're saying is just so far from reality. Where do you get this from, Eliphaz, where the good always prosper and those who are evil are always punished? Where do you get this from? But sometimes we want to boil things down and speak in platitudes. Personally, I think it's intellectual laziness. I'd rather not think about it too deeply, but just kind of give a simple, kind of one cute statement about that thing, and then I've got to summarize, figure it out, and that's it. And in this case, evil is always punished. In the end, eternally, yes, but they're talking about life on this earth. They're looking at Job's circumstance, and they have no idea what happened in the first chapter or two. And then another friend speaks up in chapter 8. And look at chapter 8, look at verse 3 through 7. And this is Bildad, one of the other friends. He speaks and he says, Job 8, look at verse 3 beginning. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? Yeah, men do, but not God. And Job never said those things, by the way, but he was not afraid to accuse him of that. Verse 4, if your sons sinned against him, then he delivered them into the power of their transgression, if you would seek God, as if Job's not doing that, and implore the compassion of the Almighty, and if you are pure and upright, surely now he would rouse himself for you and restore your righteous estate. Though your beginning was insignificant, your end will increase greatly. Again, the reasoning is this: evil always suffer, and correlating to that, those who are good will be blessed and be rewarded. And they had defined Job as evil. And Job, if all you would do is repent, everything will go away. Whatever it is, Job, we're here to help you. We're your best friends. Just figure it out. And whatever you've sinned against God, then get it right, and the suffering will stop. And the problem is, that's not Job. You know Job chapter 1, verse 1. He's blameless, he's upright, and then later on in the chapter, he's offering sacrifices for his children just in case they may have sinned. And then God and Satan have this conversation behind the scenes. Job has no clue what's going on. And Satan challenges God and says, the reason Job serves you is because you bless him. And God says, I have confidence in him, and therefore you can take everything away from him, just don't kill him, and he'll still be faithful to me. And Satan said, it's on. And Satan just goes after him. You talk about having a bad day. Kids are killed, and his wife curses him and dies, and loses all his crops, loses everything, livelihoods, everything. But that's not Job. He's not this sinner who needs to repent of anything. He's a sinner, yes, but he's not to this degree of a sinner as these three friends are trying to comfort him and say, I've got all the answers for you. Job never denies the fact that he's a sinner, but he's not sinned in a way to deserve this kind of wrath and punishment by God. And so again, Job looks within himself. And when trouble comes, it's good for us to look within ourselves as well. This introspection that James says, look at yourself in the mirror, see how things are going, look for the imperfections, try to better yourself. That's always there, but sometimes we can look very deeply into ourselves when tornadoes come through towns or when children, whatever. And Job looks at for himself and he says, look, for the life of me, I can't imagine why God will do this to me. Again, he had sort of the false conclusions that the friends had. And so he sees his own innocence compared to his suffering. And let's turn to chapter 24. In chapter 24, and look at verse 9. And again, Job sees his innocence and compared to his suffering. And he says, yeah, evil men do prosper. That happens in this world. Chapter 24, verse 9. Others snatch the orphan from the breast, and against the poor they take a pledge. In other words, yeah, people just kind of do what they want, and they do horrible things. And I don't see God punishing them in this life yet, and I don't understand how this works. But look down at verse 14 of chapter 24. Verse 14, the murderer arises at dawn, kills the poor and the needy. In the night he is a thief. And the eye of the adulterer waits for the twilight, saying, no eye will see me. And he disguises his face. In the dark they dig into houses and they shut themselves up by the day. They don't know the light, for the morning is the same to him as the thick darkness. He is familiar with the terrors of thick darkness. Down in verse 25, if these things are not so, who can prove me a liar and make my speech worthless. In other words, we can't fit life into a simple formula like the three friends had done and Job was trying to do of, okay, those who are great always will get rewarded by God, and those who sin will always be punished by God. And Job is saying, look, it doesn't work that way. Not according to what I've seen. I observe life, and I'm trying to compare what you're telling me and reconcile it with what I actually see in reality of life. But the minds of these friends, what he's trying to do is defend, I think, the integrity of God. And again, this is a false conclusion that, well, at best, he's trying to understand how do righteousness and evil work here. And what Job is accusing God of is at best indifference and at worst injustice. Okay, God, what is it? Are you just indifferent or are you unjust? And I'm trying to make sense of this, Job is. Job chapter 7, look at verse 20. Now, if you've not studied the book of Job recently, I don't know the history of your classes and lessons you've had here. I think sometimes people get caught up in a Job and thinking, well, he never cursed God, he never challenged God, he never had serious questions for God. And I just want to say that you don't have to do a lot of reading to discover that Job actually did challenge God, and he asked some pretty stiff questions of God during this ordeal. Chapter 7 and verse 20, he says, have I sinned? What have I done to you? Watcher of men, why have you set me as your target that I'm a burden to myself? Sounds to me, Job's complaining there. God, why am I on your radar screen of taking my family out and my wife? Why do you allow this to happen? Again, not knowing chapter 1 and the discussion of Satan and God behind the scenes. Look at chapter 9, look at verse 14. And again, listen to Job and what he's going to say here. It seems to me like he's going to question God here and the administration of things and his justice. Job 9, look at verse 14 beginning. How then can I answer him and choose my words before him? Though I were right, how could I not answer? I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice. He bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not allow me to get my breath. He saturates me with bitterness. It is a matter of power. Behold, he is the strong one. And if it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty. I am guiltless. Do not take notice of myself. I despise my life. It is all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys the guiltless and the wicked. If the scourge kills suddenly, he mocks the despair of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, then who is it? Again, it seems to me like Job's doing a lot of serious questioning there to God. Imagine saying to God, hey, you're the one that caused all this. You're the one that created all this misfortune, all this tragedy, God. I don't understand. How could you do this? And again, I think Job has had some very serious, stiff questions for God himself. Now look at chapter 1, verse 7. I'm sorry, chapter 10 and verse 1. Chapter 10 and verse 1. I'm going to read this with inflection. I have no idea if it's accurate or not, but I'm going to try my best to get it right. Chapter 10, verse 1. I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul, and I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. Is it right for you indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands, and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? Have you eyes of flesh? Do you see as a man sees? Are your days the days of a mortal? Are your years as man's years, that you should seek for my guilt and search after my sin? According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty. Yet therefore, there is no deliverance from your hand. Again, it seems to me like he's complaining mightily to God. Going to God, asking at the core of his being, are you good, God? God, are you fair? God, why are you nitpicking me to death? It seems to be that's what Job is exactly asking here. I'm not going to read too much more. Look at chapter 16 and look at verse 6. Job 16 and look at verse 6. Job 16, verse 6, beginning. If I speak, my pain is not lessened. And if I hold back, what is left me? But now he has exhausted me. You have laid waste all my company. You have shriveled me up. It has become a witness, and my leanness rises up against me. It testifies to my face. Again, he's talking about God here. Verse 9. His anger has torn me and hunted me down. He has gnashed at me with his teeth. My adversary glares at me. They have gaped at me with their mouth. They have slapped me on the cheek with contempt. They have massed themselves against me. God hands me over to the ruffians
that's his friends, and tosses me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he shattered me, and he has grasped me by the neck and shaken me to pieces. He also has set me up as his target. Again, notice who he's blaming here. Verse 13, his arrows surround me. Without mercy, he splits my kidneys open. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks through me with breach after breach. He runs at me like a warrior. Most of us, we heard somebody talk like that, say, how dare you blame God? That's the wrong person at all. And yet this whole speech and counter speech and all these cycle of speeches, we see this type of language pop up all the time. It's just their raw emotion flowing out, thinking, how could this happen? And Job was very eloquent about, well, speaking his mind. If you've lived any length of time on this earth, and most of you have, you'll know this life can be very harsh at times. It can be very harsh at times. How much can I take, God? How much do you think? I mean, we meander down this line of questioning. Are you aware of what they're doing to me, God? Or do you see they're destroying my reputation? My wife has turned against me. Do you see what's going on? I don't see how this can be solved. God, are you in control? You're all powerful. You're all loving. Okay, God, when's it going to happen? When am I going to get deliverance from this? I somehow find it difficult to see how you, oh God, are in control when all these things are going on. And some people may go down that path. And again, here is the mistake that Job is making. And here's a mistake some of us might make in a similar situation. Sometimes pain in this life can be so great that everything we experience is filtered through that pain. And that's a mistake we make. And if you never experience that kind of pain, please don't assume you never will. It happens to just about the best of us. It's because terrible things do happen to good people in this life. Not of their own making, not of their own circumstances. And sometimes when those things happen, we begin to question God. And that's when we begin to question God like Job is. Hey, are you fair? Are you unjust? Are you indifferent? Where are you? Job is looking at the situation, and he realizes, okay, God must be unjust, or he just must be unconcerned about this world. And I can imagine the anguish Job is going through, but he's trying to explain it to us about this tearing apart inside, about what's going on in him. Throughout the book of Job, you have this to-ing and fro-ing, these cycles and counter-cycles of speeches, and I admit, some of it's just difficult to get all the nuances and deciphering what's going on, and sometimes they repeat themselves, but sometimes Job is just getting nowhere. Maybe you've talked to people like that. You feel like you're trying to figure something out and have a pretty good debate going on. And, okay, let me tell you what I think your argument is, and you're going to tell me what you think my argument is, and we're going to try to come to a common ground here. And you're just beating your head against the wall thinking, I'm getting nowhere with this person. And you're going around and around and around, and I'm just beating a dead horse here, and you just don't understand where we're going to go with this. And I think that's what happened at the end of the cycles of speeches. By chapter 31, when those cycles of speeches end with the three friends, it's like, okay, what do we do now? You've had your say, I've had my say, and you're appealing to what the ancients have told us, you're appealing to your circumstance, and Job is saying, I don't see it that way. I don't see it that way. So now what? They keep coming after him. And then in chapter 32, you have this young friend, this young guy pop up, and he starts speaking off, and let me just bypass that for just a moment, and let's go to Job chapter 38. Let's just jump ahead a little bit here. In Job chapter 38... in these musings that Job has, several times he asks for an interview with God. He asks for a chance to speak with God. And Job's a little bit big, too big for his britches on this opportunity, but he's going to straighten God out. You know, I'm going to talk to you, and we're going to figure this out and get it right. And of course, we have to be careful for what we wish for. But in chapter 38, God, out of a whirlwind, pops up, and he starts speaking. All the philosophical meandering is done, all the experiencing what the past has done, all the appeal to what the ancients have told us and what our experience tells us, all that's over with. God is now going to speak. And he says in chapter 38 and verse 2, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Who is speaking when they shouldn't be talking? Who thinks they have all the answers when you don't? Who's so dogmatic about their opinions when you really have no clue what you're talking about? We can just paraphrase this all day, can't we? What's the appeal to authority here? What, you think you have all the answers? And this is God speaking now. It's time to talk here. There's a bit of a shock value with that. Who are you persecuting, Lord? Jesus. Okay, Paul and Jesus on the road to Damascus. God speaks. Guess who's going to win this argument? We know how this goes, and he's going to set everything straight here. And when he speaks, it's interesting that he answers these whole questions a way that I would not have answered. Can you remember reading this book of Job for the first time?
and you're thinking, you get to this point, you think, how would you answer? If it was me, I would say, hey, whoa, Job, let me tell you what's going on here. You don't know what happened in chapter 1. You don't know this is a big setup. You don't know that I had confidence in you. Let me just let you off the hook and let you know what's going on. That's what I would have done. I'm not God, clearly. Okay, God is God, and I'm not, and nobody else is, and let's be thankful for that. But God says he has a different reason. And I would just reveal all those details, put Job at ease. But God didn't do that. Why not? I don't know. I can get this observation that God offers a timeless answer. In chapters 38 through 42, he offers a timeless answer that for whatever problem may arise, maybe we can go back to Job 38 through 42 and answer those questions. If God had answered the way I thought it should have been answered, let me just tell you what happened behind the scenes. Okay, we would not have it preserved through eternity and posterity's sake for us to look at in the year 2013. It's very relevant today because what God points Job to and he points us to is a much bigger picture. What's the bigger picture here? So beginning in chapter 38, and by the way, you study with somebody who's never read the Bible before, who has a little unclear understanding of who God is or if there is a God, let me suggest to you that the questions that God asks in chapters 38 through 41 are great questions. If you're not sure, I'm an agnostic, I don't know who God is, if there is even a God, just read them the questions in chapters 38 through 41. And if you're not familiar with it, we're going to read some of them here. And just maybe that'll create some humility in some people. But chapter 38, verse 4. I'm going to speak about his creative power and his ingenuity and his wisdom. Chapter 38, verse 3. Gird up your loins like a man. I'll ask and you instruct me, God says. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who has set its measurements? And since you know, who stretched the line on it? Where were its bases sunk? Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? You can go a lot of different directions with that. It's amazing to me that NASA gets real excited when they have something land on Mars. And, oh, a bunch of dust we kicked up and this is exciting, this is wonderful, this is great. And the excitement over some magnetic shift or however that works in space. And is there another planet and another galaxy circling another sun like ours and another galaxy like ours? And all the heavens and all the earth and all that points to is just how unique this planet we live on is. Do we not take this planet for granted? Are we just looking out for something else? Alien life and the X factor out there. Trying to prove that there's another God or there is no God. Or trying to prove evolution or trying to prove the Big Bang instead of looking at what precious life God has given us here. Have we lost a sense of wonder and a sense of awe of what God has given us here and now, perhaps? I'm not going to turn this into an evidences lesson, obviously, but the more we understand about what it takes for life to exist on this planet, the 24-hour cycle sits on an axis of 23.5 degrees, we're 93 million miles away from the sun, 94 million miles, not going to work, 92 million miles, not going to work, we're just right. All those variables come into place, and we have to ask ourselves, how did that happen? How did that happen? And God is saying, I did that. Now, Job, can you do that? Were you there? To anybody who's skeptical of God, okay, who did that? How and why? For us to glorify and worship him. Job knew enough about God to not challenge him and ask, okay, tell me, Job, how'd you do that? How'd I do that, Job? And chapter 38, look at verse 8. He's going to turn from the planet itself and turn to the physical properties of it. And chapter 38, look at verse 8. Who enclosed the sea with doors when bursting forth it went out from the womb? When I made a cloud its garment and thick darkness of swaddling band and I placed boundaries on it, I set a bolt in doors and I said, thus far shall come, but no further, and there shall your proud waves stop. Look down at verse 16. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked into the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of the death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Tell me, if you know all of this. What's the answer to that? Silence. Nobody's ever been that far down to the sea. We've been pretty far, but not that far. Again, God is asking these questions and wants answers. And your answer is no, never been there, can't explain, don't understand. And it goes on for chapter. And we lived in New Orleans area back in 2005. Went through Katrina. What a mess that was. What a powerful storm that was. Powerful. And I remember that year was a record year for numbers of hurricanes. And then at the end of that year, guess what? We're going to have forecast more of hurricanes the next year. We thought, oh, great. Not again. And sure enough, the next year there were zero hurricanes. Like, God gave us a break. It's like, okay, they were wrong. Yeah, that happens. They think they have it all figured out, and they're wrong. I remember just before that, There was a terrible tsunami in Indonesia. A couple thousand were killed, just a terrible third world country, poor situation. But this tsunami stirred up so much of the ocean depth that washed up about 2,000 new species of fish they never documented before. And the argument was, okay, there must be more down there. We just have no clue what's down there. So when we think we have it all figured out, we just don't. And something else happens where we learn more about more stuff. And so whether we're talking about El Nino or La Nina or the development of hurricanes or the new species in the waters or whatever it is, as smart as we think we are, we have no clue about the impact of the oceans on the atmosphere that we have and everything else that goes. We have no clue. And do we have the humility to understand that or not? Peter then turns to the atmosphere. In chapter 38, look at verse 22. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Have you seen the storehouses of hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress, for the day of the war and battle? Where is the way that the light is divided, or the east wind scatters on the earth? And again, Job doesn't know. Who has cleft a channel for the flood, or the way of a thunderbolt, to bring rain on land without people, on a desert without a man in it, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the seeds of grass to sprout? And it goes on. Look at verse 34, verse 34 through 38. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that the abundance of water will cover you? Can you send forth lightnings wherever they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? Who can count the clouds by wisdom? Or tip the water jars of the heavens, when the dust hardens into a mass and the clods stick together. But God is saying, look, I designed that. And God is saying, I did that. And God is saying, I brought these things into existence. And Job, I think, is saying, look, Job, I'm intimately aware with my creation. I made it, I created it for purpose, and I'm intimately aware with my creation. And your shortcomings do not suggest that I'm ignorant or I'm not capable of dealing with my creation. I'm very aware of what's going on here, Job. And this is, I think, God is saying to Job, even if I explained it to you, why all these things work, you just wouldn't understand. Again, God is God, and we're not. Again, it's humility. Then God affirms his omnipotent nature. I'm not going to read this, chapter 39. Let me just say this. He talks about the dumb ostrich. He compares that, and he talks about an ostrich that has not been endowed with a great deal of intelligence. From a non-evolutionary viewpoint, the question is begged, that teaches, rather, survival of the fittest. How come nature did not select the ostrich who's so dumb and just evolved it out of existence? How does that not work? And what God is saying is, I created that thing for a purpose, and I've got the dumb ostrich, I've got the eagles, I've got the peregrine falcon that goes, what, 200 miles an hour, 180 miles an hour? And God says, I made all those, and every bird in between, and I know very well what I've created and why. There's a purpose there for that. I made the majestic birds what they are, and I made everything the way it is. And so we think about the variables it takes for existence on Earth and inanimate things. Think about gravity and what that does for us. And add to the human influence. And God has been working on mankind ever since Genesis 1. What has mankind ever done? And you know, you might as well say, go ahead and mess it up if you can. Go ahead and mess up my creation if you can. Do you think we can mess up God's creation if we decided to do that? Absolutely not. We're going to interrupt God's plan at all. You know, whatever we do, we're not going to interrupt that. And it's pretty arrogant for people to think that we can. Al Gore makes a lot of money claiming human global warming out there. And Earth goes in cycles. It's warm, it's cold, and it goes in these cycles up and down. I have two friends who are scientists, PhD in science. One's a preacher, and they'll tell you, yeah, Al Gore's wrong. He'll say, no, all scientists agree with me. No, he's wrong about that. And he's making several hundred millions of dollars by peddling that stuff, thinking we can just upset this. Yeah, of course we want clean air. Of course we want clean water and all those things. But we have free will. We can do what we want. But we're not going to upset God's plan. If he wants a place for us to live, for us to breathe and to interact and worship and love him and serve him, and he's given us this earth, he's going to sustain that by his breath. He can speak things into existence. That's how powerful God is. Go back and read Genesis 1. But what we have done is perfected evil. What is mankind good at? Evil. And we perfected it. It even rose up against the Son of God, and it killed the Son of God. But even then, God's plan still worked itself out, did it not? That's the kind of God we serve. You can do all you want to him, and he's still going to, okay, I'm still going to find a way to, don't worry, I got this. He's in control. We have a contrast. We have some pretty smart people in there. I'm not going to Anybody know who Thomas Andrews was? This is a class I'd ask you. Some of you are smiling. You know exactly who he is. He was the designer of that ship. Lead architect, designer of the Titanic. And I'm going to read for you a text of his last post before he jumped on the ship and took off. He said, "The Titanic is now about complete. We're going to do the Old Firm credit tomorrow when we sail." And that Old Firm was the White Star Lines. What confidence Thomas Andrews had in his creation, and what a creation it was. "I'm confident in this thing is going to set sail, and it'll be the greatest thing ever, and the biggest thing ever." And, of course, a little bit overconfident, as we know. Just took a chunk of ice, and water started to come in, and Andrews was on the ship, and he was called down to go investigate, and he came back. He said, "Yeah, we hit a pretty good chunk of ice, and it's going to go down in about 2 hours. Nothing I can do to save my creation." You see the contrast? We can make things, and it takes something very small to just destroy it. And it's out of his hands. He knew every inch of that ship, and he knew well enough that this thing's done in a matter of time. Is that who God is? Not at all. He's made his creation, and he can sustain it. And even when we perfect evil, he's still going to be there to say, I got this. I'm in control here. And my will is going to be done. But how many of us have made Titanics and just crumbles in our lap or blows up in our face and think, yikes. And that should teach us a little humility about, we shouldn't stop trying, but there's some things we've got to try on. My point is that Andrews died in the sinking. Again, you see the contrast, I hope, about what we create. And he's helpless to save this ship. God is not so helpless. We serve a God that controls us, that created us, his specifications. Even the dumb ostrich has purpose and meaning in this life. And we have to be careful to not let the pain and disappointments and anguish to trump our belief and our faith and our confidence in God who created all things, who sustains all things. There's a couple things here. Let me wrap it up here. Some of the anguish Job went through, I don't think Job understood that God still cared for him. And that must have been anguishing. To think God doesn't care for me, because that's what Job goes through. How can you let this happen? Do you not love me anymore? Peter tells us in 1 Peter 5:7, cast all our cares and anxieties on him. What cares do you have? What anxieties do you have? Do you turn to the Lord with those? Or are you turning to your own devices? Everything that God has done throughout history. Read the book of Nehemiah. You're studying that Sunday morning. Read anything else. And he's doing everything to demonstrate his love for us and his care and his concern for us. Jesus went through some horrendous things and some hurtful things, even the crucifixion, all for us because he loves us. That's how far God is willing to go to show his devotion to us and his love for us. Jesus kept trusting in himself to God, and he kept saying to the Father, "I have confidence in you, and you're going to be exalted at the proper time." And Job could not reconcile the fact, how does God care for me with all this going on? Number two, Job did not see God's confidence in him. And I think this is probably the most difficult thing Job went through. Can you imagine God not having confidence in you? I'm not sure I can trust him, so we're not going to give him that task. And that's what Job was thinking. And yet, that's the complete opposite of what happened in chapter 1. I have confidence, Satan, that you can do what you can. He's not going to stop turning to me. And poor Job didn't know that. But again, the answer he gives is a timeless one. God had confidence enough to allow Satan to challenge Job. Let me ask you this question. When you're facing a difficult time in life, whatever pain, whatever suffering, whatever trial that's out there, or you hear about tornadoes killing kids in Oklahoma City, could it be that God is saying, I'm letting those things happen to see how faithful you are, and maybe this is a chance to grow in your faith? Could that be the case? And that's not the answer you want to hear when you're in the midst of that, going through that, but maybe it just is the answer that God is saying, do you really believe in me? And can we make this a better faith and a stronger faith to be more mature? And if he's looking down in heaven with confidence in you, thinking he's going to get through this, that's a blessing. That's a blessing that he has confidence in you to go through this, and he's counting on you to get through this. And finally, number three, Job could not reconcile his circumstances with God's silence. And that's the worst. You want answers? Give me a no answer. Well, God was silent. I'm not going to give you an answer until chapter 38. They go through 37 chapters before God finally speaks up and says, let me tell you this answer, but I'm not going to tell you what all the whole I'm going to give you something else. Well, God did not respond to Job in a particular question. He considered it to be God's anger against him, and he didn't understand why. And again, I think the warning for us is we cannot put God into a box. God must work this way, and if it doesn't work that way, then everything's shattered. No, it doesn't work that way. We cannot subject God to this type of thinking. Well, if God doesn't answer my prayer like I think he should, then he must be unloving, he must be unjust, he must be unfair. No, don't think that. There's nothing wrong with God. He knows, and he cares, and things are going to get done. And our faith must see through the wilderness in life. We must pass through this life, and things will get better for us, obviously. So the question of chapter 38 and verse 2 of, who is this that darkens counsel without knowledge? Yeah, who is that? Let me ask you a series of questions. And what an amazing set of questions they are. It's so easy to be faithful when God is blessing us and things are going great. But when trials are there and the turmoils of life and are just there, that's when the test of character is challenged and we need to rise up and stand to that. Think about this. We sing the song, "This World Is Not My Home." Could it be tornadoes like that happen? And other things happen, we can just go on a list. Katrina happens and tsunamis happen. To be reminded of the fact that this world is not our home. Because those things always happen, and they've always happened throughout history. And what God is saying, don't get too comfortable in this world. Stop trying to make this world your home. No, we need to sing that song, "This World Is Not My Home," and have meaning to it. Because this world has nothing to offer. Are we citizens of this world? Or are we citizens of heaven trying to get through this world? That's what we are. We're citizens of heaven trying to get through this world. And tsunamis, earthquakes, tornadoes, other things, maybe they're there to help us remind us of that fact that our faith needs to be in him. And we need to always seek first the kingdom. Okay, take your songbooks out. Turn to the song that's been selected. It was mentioned that we're from Georgia. Well, we lived in Georgia. We live in Georgia now, but we're actually from California. And we migrated in Tucson for a little while, then knew a lot of you here, Chad and Holly Wagner and Janelle, back in our days in Tucson. And then before that, we were in Folsom, California, knew Lance, and we knew my friend Matt and Betsy Malore, who are here from Valley. Matt was my best man at my wedding. Good to be reunited with all these West Coasters that we've known from so many years ago, and it's good to be out here with you. And my prayer is, and it's been the prayer that I've heard last few days, as you go through this process, that you find the person you think is most effective. That's what you need to find. What are you looking for? What's the objective? And you find someone who is effective. Will that be me or someone else? I don't know. But that's a prayer that needs to be uttered regularly and with wisdom and with humility, but that gets done. And that's what we want done, is God to be glorified. Always looking in our Bibles, always looking for answers there. That's the appeal, and that must always be done. If you do that, yeah, God will bless you in your efforts, no matter what you're doing. So the appeal is, put God first. Have you put God first in your life? If you haven't, are you ready to do it now? You heard some of those questions God had. Where were you when I made the creation? Where were you when I made the ostrich? Where were you? I wasn't there, but okay, God, you're in control. And I'm ready to serve you, and I'm ready to put you first, and I'll be part of your creation that you can save. No matter if icebergs hit my life or not, I will be saved because my faith and confidence and trust is in you. So if you have any needs at all, would you please come forward as we stand and as we sit.